Sheriff's member, so our meeting will now come to order. We'll begin as we usually do with the Pledge of Allegiance, and you're welcome to join us.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. And I'd like to ask that everybody, if you have cell phones, please turn them off or silence them for us. Thank you. We do have a quorum, and our voting members today shall be Mr. Intermill, Mr. Carlson, Mr. Hannigan, Ms. Davies, and Mr. Thurber. Let's see, we are missing Mr. Intermill, so the voting members' correction will be Mr. Carlson, Mr. Hannigan, Ms. Davies, Mr. Thurber, and the chair. And we will start with the staff introduction, and then we'll hear from the applicant and continue.
Good morning, board. Nice to see you all again. I think a few months ago, I promised that I would provide you with an annual report of kind of all the things planning and community development. I've already done this presentation for the Planning Commission as well as the Board of County Commissioners. Not that I'm leaving you last, but I think maybe saving the best for last. More happenstance with timing of hearings than anything. I'm going to go through quite a bit of information. I do have to be downtown at 9 on that clock or 10 on any other formal clock, so I will get through this pretty quickly. Some of the things I'm going to cover some of the annual stats that we track. Probably the biggest thing that'll take up a lot of the time, or at least maybe have the biggest impact, is some of the code enforcement abatement projects that we undertook during 2017. Cover some of the land development code amendments that we processed, some of the operational changes, how we're trying to be more efficient and more transparent, and then kind of what we're looking forward to this year and into the future. One of the things that we track is major development applications. You can see on this graph where sort of the recession hit, and the bottom being in 2011. In 2007, we were at 397 type C and D projects. These are, you know, subdivisions. These are rezonings. These are, in your case, board of adjustment requests. Things that typically require either a hearing or at a minimum, a planner and engineer to be assigned to them. As you can see, we came out of the recession. We're basically back where we were pre-recession. The difference being that in 2007, we had 18 staff members that would review those projects, about 400. That represented 22.1 projects per reviewer. In 2017, we averaged 40.8 projects per reviewer with a total of 9 reviewers. So essentially the same amount of work with half the staff. Obviously that's not going to work long term. Some of the efficiencies that we did create doing the electronic review, those are all good and fine, and they make things more efficient for the applicants and for the outside agencies, but the review is the review is the review. That doesn't go away. We're in the process of trying to hire at least 2 more engineers. Our engineers averaged 122 projects each last year. Again, that is not sustainable. So we're looking to shift those numbers slightly. Just kind of a quick report on what's happening already in 2018. For January, we were down 16 year over year from 2017, but in February, we were in excess by 24. I don't think either of those are indicative of what we're going to see on average. Usually we're around 30 projects per month. We also track our minor development applications. These are applications that come in over the front counter. These are things like driveway permits, minor commercial site plans, single family residences. Year over year, we're basically the same. We saw a slight increase of only 4. However, the revenue went up about $5,000. And we're basically doing that same work with the same amount of staff that we had last year, but again, we have less staff than we had pre-recession. One of the things we look at in terms of growth indicators is the number of single-family residence starts, not only in the county, but in the region. You can see that from 2014 to 2017. The number has grown significantly for the city of Colorado Springs. A lot of that is representative of multifamily housing that's come online. There's a huge push, I think, both by the city and maybe even by the building community to densify the city as a result of some of the overextension of infrastructure. But if you look at the regional totals year over year, we continue to be in the positive in terms of percent of growth, or percent of increase, rather. One of the things that kind of goes unnoticed a lot of times is the fact that our office does construction inspections. We do not leave that up to the Public Works Department. We have an inspection staff that goes out and inspects various things associated with development. 2017 was the first year that we started what we call our sidewalk inspections program. We inspected 606 sidewalk inspections. That's not stones, that's number of lots that we inspected. 86 of those failed for a failure rate of about 14%. What that means is only those that didn't get repaired failed, that were actually had damage. I suspect there were some that were repaired before we ever went out and inspected. So we're estimating that just with these numbers, it saves the county about $100,000, somewhere between $70,000 and $100,000, probably in excess of that when you figure they're probably repairing a lot of them before we even get out there. That's a big deal, because before we were taking these sidewalks on only to have to go out, conceptually, go out and repair those sidewalks that are already damaged when we accepted them. That was a complete change in how we do business, and I think it's been very positive up to this point. We accepted approximately 11 miles of sidewalks valued at almost $1.2 million. A team of essentially three, sometimes four inspectors inspected not only the 606 sidewalk inspections, but also just over 1,300 driveway inspections, 300 stormwater inspections, and about 1,700 subdivision inspections. That is a lot of activity for a team of three or four. We're not proposing to increase that, which is really too bad. The budget's just not there, but those guys do a lot with the staff that they have. We also do co-inspections with the Public Works Department on the tail end of improvements when we're ready to go through final acceptance and transition that over to county maintenance. Up until that point, it's kind of been under our review and making sure that it meets the approved plans. At some point towards the back end, we go through the final acceptance with our inspections group to turn it over to their group for ongoing maintenance and ownership. We also look at the value of the public improvements that came in. I'm going to summarize this really quickly. There's a lot of numbers on the screen here. We were down from 2016 by about $8 million. I think 2016 was kind of an anomaly. A lot of that stuff was stuff that had been in the hopper for a while. I do think that you're going to see an increase, and the reason why is because at the bottom there, you can see that the amount of financial assurance that we accepted in 2017 far exceeds by almost $4 million the amount of financial assurance we released. So there's an increase of about $4 million. That tells me there's a lot of improvements that are coming in and ultimately will be accepted. Also, there was approximately 6.5 miles of additional lane miles added to the system as a result of development. The remainder of that was capital improvement projects that the county developed. Probably the division within our department that saw the biggest increase in terms of the amount of time committed was our code enforcement group. We have a code enforcement group of three officers. We now have four. During 2017, it was three. They looked at 865 complaints versus almost 1,100 from 2016. I think the primary reason for the decrease was the amount of rain that you saw early in 2016. We had a ton of weed complaints. You can see it was an increase of almost 300, which really makes up the difference. Zoning complaints, actually, we saw an increase of about 30. That's when we have illegal uses happening on the properties. We work very closely with the county attorney's office to process all these complaints, get them not only to the Board of County Commissioners, but also on to court to, in some cases, get an entry warrant to clean up the property, whatever the case may be. On that note, one of the changes that we made to the Land Development Code and to some of the ordinances for rubbish and weeds allows my position now to authorize litigation versus having to take it to the Board of County Commissioners. Most of the time, we take a whole list of properties and nobody shows up. complaining that they shouldn't be in the code enforcement process. It's really a very time-consuming process, not only for staff, but also for the Board of County Commissioners. That now is something that we can authorize at my level and work with the county attorney's office. There's still an appeal process to the board, but as so far through 2018, we have not received one request to appeal any of those determinations. What I'm going to show you is some of the abatement projects that we took on. There was a total of seven. Six of those came out of our department's budget. We have a line item for $25,000 for cleanup from 2017, 2018, that got increased to $35,000. I think you'll probably see why after you see the same photos that the Board of County Commissioners saw. Historically, though, we've only really done like one or two here and there, very minor. This is really kind of a change in how we do business as far as code enforcement goes. So going through the projects, as I said to the Board of County Commissioners, we're going to start small and we're going to get bigger. And you'll see what I mean when we go through the photos. The first one was in the Widefield area. It only cost $600. This was a weed cleanup case. These weeds were somewhere in the neighborhood of 6 to 7 feet tall. These are the before pictures, and that's the after. This was probably a more severe case of weeds. Again, it kind of depends on the moisture we get and what's happening from the climate standpoint. Next one was in Calhoun. This was a one-day cleanup. It took five truckloads, approximately $2,000. Kind of a side note on this one is the property owner had some severe family issues, had lost a child, was in the process of going through a very ugly divorce. We prioritize this for that reason, but also in that area of the county, trash tends to blow much further than in other areas of the county. So we want to make sure we got on top of it before created a bigger problem. So these are the before and after photos. A lot of this was just household waste. They didn't have trash service. We wanted to kind of set them back to the starting line and make it so that if they did get trash service, that this wouldn't happen again. Next one was in the security area, about $2,800. It was a one-day cleanup, seven truckloads. This was kind of a lot of hodgepodge stuff. You'll see here that the building actually burned after we cleaned up the property. We are now looking at this building as a dangerous building that potentially we can work with regional building on. It is really uninhabitable as it sits right now. And that brings up another issue. We actually changed. We worked with regional building to change the building code to add the dangerous building section of the building code back into applicability for the county. We are the only jurisdiction that is served by regional building that did not have that in there. And a lot of the apprehension with that is we might try to impose that on some of the old agricultural structures out east. That is not the intent. As a matter of fact, when we added it back in, we said that it could only apply to structures that were intended to be habitable. So we're hoping that we can move forward with structures like this. Matter of fact, we've had this happen on two different homes where the home was partially burned and destroyed, and people are still living in them. So again, a lot of just regular household waste thrown out in the front yard. A lot of here's and there's in the backyard. This is the after, cleaned up and kind of organized. Next one is in Widefield. This was a two-day cleanup. It was 12 truckloads, approximately $4,700. As you can see, we're growing in intensity in terms of the amount of stuff that had to be cleaned up. Just a hodgepodge of stuff again.
Can I ask a question? Does this become the cost of this become a lien on these people's property, or how does this work?
We send them a bill. If they do not pay the bill, then it becomes a lien. It is not, the rest of us are not paying for this. We're paying for it in the interim, but long term, the county will get paid back. If you needed a bicycle, this probably would have been the right place to go. I think there was like 50-some bicycles. This was the front yard. They did have a dumpster on site. As you can tell, they'd made good use of that. However, they did not actually dump the dumpster, which just added to the mix. Next was the Calhoun area. This was a four-day cleanup, 23 truckloads. I actually visited this property during the process of cleanup. Sort of a compound of sorts, a lot of fencing, a lot of walls. A lot of the neighboring properties look down into this property. So we had received a lot of complaints. This structure that's in the background, there's no evidence that they received a building permit. However, there's also no evidence that it was not existing prior to the requirement for a building permit. So potentially this could be a dangerous building in the future. Kind of a side note, the property owner and the property owner's son made threats both to the sheriff's deputies that served the warrant as well as our code enforcement officers. So the next time you see a code enforcement officer, please be sure to tell them thank you, because that's a rough job. But ultimately we got it done. We used Junk King on that one, and Junk King's been great to work with. The next one was in the security area. This was a two-day cleanup, 17 truckloads, approximately $5,800. There's just a bunch of stuff. There's really no rhyme or reason to it. Kind of the underlying side note here, each of these structures that is in the backyard, these accessory structures, not each of them, but some of them were actually occupied by individuals. There was no heat in these structures. Obviously, they were not intended for occupation. I think it's important to note when you see things like this, and I talk about cleanup, we're not just standing there watching Junk King or whoever else clean up the property. Our code enforcement officers are rolling up their sleeves and actually getting in and helping do the work to try to expedite the process. So they're doing a great job, and I think they've really kind of reached out to the community, because as you can imagine, when we go in and clean up a property like this, the neighbors are almost in tears when they see us roll up with whoever we've hired to do the work. It's really a great thing. I don't always like the idea of government kind of footing the bill, but again, we are going to get repaid. So easily the biggest cleanup that the county has ever seen was in Park Vista. There were, I can't remember the number, 13 construction trailers that were located on this property. The property owner was changing his company name over and over and over again, making it difficult to serve. Ultimately, we had to work with our Public Works Department and our Environmental Services Department to get enough funds to clean this property up. We were finally able to serve this individual. Again, this is really in an enclave within the city. This is near Austin Bluffs and Oro Blanco. This is a county road. Some of these structures were actually sticking into the right-of-way. We were with Public Works in the interim before we could get the entry warrant to move these structures back into the property because there was a safety issue there. But ultimately, we were able to clean up all of this, and I'll show you some pictures of how that got cleaned up. What was happening here is some of the homeless, some of the folks that have addiction issues, as well as teenagers, were hanging out in these structures. And in a couple cases, we actually had two people living in two of the structures with their dry cleaning hanging and stoves already plugged in. I guess those are propane, but it was a mess. And it was creating a huge problem because immediately next door was a residential neighborhood. You can only imagine what we found when we went in there. It was very unpleasant. So we did hire a consultant or a contractor. They came in with a front end loader and essentially destroyed the structures on site. There was some scrap value that they were able to realize from the cleanup, but it ended up costing the county about $110,000 to clean these up. This is one of those cases where the county will probably never recover the full amount that it costs. I don't believe this property is probably worth that. It's at some point the county had to step in and help the neighborhood. The home over here was actually hosting their son's rehearsal dinner 2 days after the cleanup finished. They were delighted that it occurred when it did. So overall, the county spent about $135,000. Obviously, a big chunk of that was the one on Date Street to do the cleanup. That was seven properties. Again, the Board of County Commissioners has increased our department fund from $25,000 to $35,000. So we hope to be able to do even more this year.
Was there recorded criminal activity as well on the date property, that it was a health safety issue? With
there were a lot of reports, but, you know, unless you're kind of there, it's really challenging. You know, I talked about the county attorney's office, but the sheriff's office plays a huge role in this process. They were on site the entire time. Media was very present at the time because we'd really never done anything like that. But a lot of the residents had contacted some of the local news stations saying the county wasn't doing anything or wasn't doing anything. But it was an issue of having of being able to serve the property owner. And that's really the most frustrating part is we can do everything we can do in an expedited manner, but if we can't get it through the court, you know, the timeline's really out of our control. So I think by giving my position the authority to authorize litigation, it at least expedites our end of it even that much faster. But a lot of times there's it's out of our control once it gets to court. But there were a lot of reports of illegal activity, yes. Several of the code amendments that we processed, you may or may not be aware, the county now allows for tiny homes. We have regulations that specifically address tiny homes. Previously, we didn't address it, so therefore they weren't allowed, so you'd have to ask for a variance. A lot of time and energy put into that. Matter of fact, Commissioner VanderWerf was just at a speaking engagement in Oregon yesterday talking about what we did with tiny homes, and I expect that it at least becomes a starting point for a lot of other jurisdictions around the country as to how to best begin to address tiny homes. We did several other code amendments dealing with parking and storage and repair of vehicles, and a lot of that had to do with code enforcement issues. Site planning for ADA compliance, we actually required a note to be placed on the commercial site development plans. And then we just kind of did general code cleanup. We're always in the process of doing that. It's nothing new. But as we use it and get frustrated on our end by it or on the other side of the table, it's important that we track that and make those changes. Easily the biggest operational change that our department maybe has ever seen, certainly in my time with the county, which is 10 years now, we finalized and activated the first phase of our EDARP system, which allows for applications to come in electronically for the major development applications. This saves the consultants and developers approximately $2,000 on every application, not having to just print 30 copies of everything. Also, our referrals go out to those outside agencies immediately rather than having to wait for Pony Express or whatever method we use for distributing those. And then we also added in our early assistance meeting applications. It's a huge shift in how we do things. We are literally just a matter of weeks away from being completely paperless. What that means is even our minor development applications that occur at the front counter, we are very close to having those be fully electronic as well. In 2017, we hired Forsgren Associates as our lead consultant to develop the county water master plan. We have a 12-member steering committee. Mr. Hannigan, I believe, is on our committee. We have our next meeting in just a couple weeks. We went through the process of trying to mine data from all the various water providers in the county. You may think that that's not a huge undertaking, but it's approximately, I think we said 62. Jerry, was that how many we said? 62, right. 63 water providers. Yep. We're at the point now where we have responses from what ends up being about 98% of the population in terms of the water providers that provide to that amount of population. So we're in a good place with that. Ultimately, the goal of the Water Master Plan is to have it adopted by the Planning Commission in the fourth quarter of 2018. So we have a very aggressive timeline. But what kind of my plan is after that to go through the process of updating our master plan, our land use master plan. I felt very strongly that we had to go through this water master planning process before we could get into the land use aspects of it. Moving forward, as I mentioned, the type A's and B's, we're hoping that those will be up and running for through EDARP. We're also looking at doing a co-inspection module in that electronic. It includes GPS and the ability to upload photos for inspections as well as code enforcement. And then, you know, looking at some other things in terms of updates to the ECM and the land development code. Hope that wasn't too long. You have any questions for me?
Yeah, I had one. In the beginning, you talked about the number of plans that are getting reviewed per reviewer and so forth. And isn't that a self-sustaining system? I mean, couldn't you just hire more reviewers and it gets paid for through the number of applicants?
If it were that easy, then in concept, yes, it would be the answer. The problem is, and I know several have heard me say this, when things are going really well out in the on the private side, they too are also looking for engineers. I've posted engineering positions at the state level numerous times to receive all of about two or three applications, and not one from the Denver metro area. We've offered jobs. We've been denied three times now in the last 6 or 7 months. So it's not a matter of whether or not we have the funds to hire those positions. It's a matter of whether or not we can actually attract qualified candidates.
Really?
We are posting nationwide because of the desire, I think, across really from the Pacific to Atlantic to move to Colorado. We're getting more applications, but they're also applying in the private sector. Talking with a lot of the developers, they're having challenges hiring engineers, and they can pay more than I can. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to get a little more creative, but it is definitely getting frustrating. So I guess, as I said, when you see your code enforcement officer, give him a hug. When you see one of our engineers, give him a high five, or maybe let him hide in the closet and take a nap for a little while. They're working very, very hard, and their workloads are extremely high. They're doing a great job, but it's really on me to try to get people in those positions. But it's very frustrating right now. It's really a problem that the entire state has. And I know that the Denver metro counties and cities are dealing with the same issue.
I have no idea. Thank you.
Yeah. Any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Gossie.
Thank you all.
Thank you. Thanks.
So we have one item for a consent item, and that is the approval of the meeting minutes summary. Did you all have a chance to look at those?
Oh, yeah.
And were there any changes or corrections required? Seeing none, we'll deem the summary of the minutes from the previous meeting approved. So what we'll do next is we'll hear staff will just give us a brief presentation of why we're here today, and then we'll hear from the applicant. We'll give the public an opportunity to speak in favor or against. I don't see any, but staff member part of the public too, so we'll give a chance. And then you have a chance to close, and then we'll have discussion, take a motion, and vote. And I will note that the board's decision today is final unless it's appealed to the Board of County Commissioners. You have that right if you need to. And with that, staff.
Thank you, Nina Reese with Planning and Community Development for the Dion Tiny House. This is file number BOA-18-002. So this is a request to allow for an accessory structure to exceed the size of a home. Our team consists of myself and Gilbert LaForce as the engineer. So first we'll have Lori Siegel go over the review criteria.
Good morning, board members. The criteria that you see on the screen in front of you are the criteria that are being recommended, I believe, by staff in order to, if you choose to find or choose to approve this application. And I'll just summarize them. You can grant variances from the physical requirements of the code based upon an equitable consideration. If you find that the burdens of strict compliance with those requirements in the code exceed the benefits of the compliance, and you must find one of the following three circumstances exist. Either that the variance provides only reasonably brief and temporary relief, or that the variance includes an alternate plan, standards or conditions that mitigate the impacts of the variance or serve as a reasonably equivalent substitute for the zoning requirements, or finally that some other unique or equitable consideration compels that strict compliance not be required.
Thank you. So the property is zoned RR5 and is surrounded by other RR5 properties as well. The lot is 1.36 acres in size. So if you take a look at the aerial, here is the existing accessory structure, and the yellow lines show the lot lines. You can see that in the area there's several houses that have been rebuilt after the fire. There's still a few vacant parcels around, but for the most part they are starting the rebuilding process. So to give you some background on this property, the area was platted in 1929 and then zoned in 1967. So because the area was platted before zoning, you see a lot of nonconformities in the Brentwood area, and there have been many dimensional variances that have been granted for that reason as well. The Land Development Code does allow for a substandard lot size, provided that you combine or merge all of the parcels together. So they completed that process in 2003 and combined all of their parcels, individual parcels together to create that 1.36 acre lot. So the lot size is currently considered legal nonconforming at 1.36 acres, even though the zoning district requires 5 acres. Unfortunately, this property was part of the Black Forest Fire in 2013. Following the fire, the Board of County Commissioners relaxed several of the regulations to allow people to rebuild. One of those relaxations was allowing for an accessory structure to be constructed prior to the residents on site, which isn't traditionally allowed within the RR5. So in 2013, the applicants received approval of an agricultural permit to allow for the accessory structure of 2,160 square feet. Then in 2017, as you just heard discussed, the Board of County Commissioners approved the tiny house regulations, which allowed for structures that we consider tiny houses. So there's no size limitation for a single family dwelling within unincorporated El Paso County. The reason for the change had to do more with the construction standards of the tiny houses, because many of those that you find available for purchase or that are being constructed do not meet building code standards. So these tiny houses are now allowed with specific restrictions. Those are included in your packets. So if the request were to be approved, the applicant would have to seek approval of a tiny house site plan to show that that proposed tiny house meets the requirements that the Board of County Commissioners passed and approved. We kind of covered the size of the lot. So the lot is under 2.5 acres, or yes, 2.5 acres in size. So that means that in order to meet the requirements, their accessory structure would have to equal the size of their home, which in this instance means that they would have to build a home that is a minimum of 2,160 square feet, and that is just the footprint. So that means if they had a two-story home that was, let's say, 1,500 square feet for their footprint, they still wouldn't meet that requirement. The actual footprint would have to be 2,160 square feet. Built into the tiny house regulations was the acknowledgement that many people are going to want to have a larger accessory structure than the size of their tiny house, just so that they can have a traditional size garage. But that allowance capped out at 500 square feet, so they also don't get the benefit of the tiny house allowance either, because they're exceeding that 500 square feet. So because of that, they are requesting today to allow for an accessory structure that exceeds the size of their anticipated home. So the accessory structure is, again, 2,160 square feet. And then the anticipated size of their home is 390. Let me check my notes and make sure that that's correct. Yes, 390 square feet in size. The applicant will address this in their presentation, but in their letter of intent, they discuss some constraints with the lot itself as well, which are shown on this site plan. So the lot itself doesn't meet our size requirement of 5 acres, so they're automatically limited. They also have some constraints due to topography as well as drainage that goes through the property. So the only buildable area for their lot is this central portion of the parcel. Staff has visited the site and found that to be true. Along The roadway, so along Brentwood Drive, as well as Daisy Street, is very steep. And staff also did see that there is a natural drainage flow that goes through the property and kind of bisects it. So there are four potential alternatives that the applicant could explore that wouldn't require seeking a dimensional variance before the Board of Adjustment. The first one would be to demolish the accessory structure. The second one would be to demolish a portion of the accessory structure so that it doesn't exceed the allowance of the tiny house accessory structure size of 500 square feet. The third would be to not place a tiny house or construct a substandard sized home on property. So that would mean that the accessory structure would be the only structure on the property forever and ever. Or to construct a home that's at least 2,160 square feet or larger. And the applicant can explain why these alternatives are not feasible.
I have a question.
Sure.
You did state that this is zoned as a residential property. So
correct.
Three is technically not.
It is because the Board of County Commissioners approved the
okay,
or provided
so
a relaxation of the regulations
okay.
after the fire. So because they have been given all of those permits and they obtained all of the proper permits, it could remain as is. Now, if they were to start using that structure for commercial purposes, then that would be a violation. But if they're just using it for their own personal storage, it's not a problem, even though normally it would be in the RR5. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. So should the request be approved, staff has two recommended conditions of approval. So the first one is that the approval would only apply to what is proposed today, so only for the home as proposed today and the size of the accessory structure as proposed today. The condition number two would be that they obtain a tiny house site plan prior to placement of the home. Six adjacent property owners were notified of the request, and we did receive two responses in favor for the request. The property was also posted with a sign as well. So that concludes my staff presentation. Gilbert is here to answer any engineering questions, if you have any. Do you have any questions for myself or for Gilbert?
Anyone have any questions? No.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I do have one. And that is, so as far as your alternatives, would converting part of the existing accessory structure into living space be an alternative?
Yeah, that is one that we didn't include in there, simply because what they got was an ag exemption. So with the ag exemption, they didn't obtain a building permit. So that is a possibility for them, but legalizing a structure for building purposes is possible, but it's somewhat difficult. So that one, it could be included as a fifth option, but it would require getting a building permit to legalize the existing structures and to allow for the conversion of a portion of the structure. And then they could do it.
It is an option, it just may be an impractical one.
Right.
But
it could be a fifth option on there. Yeah.
Thank you. Any other questions? All right. With that, we can hear from the applicant. And if I could get you to sign our little log there for us. Thank you.
Good morning. I appreciate you guys' time this morning, and I'd also like to especially thank Nina Rez for guiding me through this system. I went to Nina after the county decided that the tiny houses would be okay. My wife and I had been looking at tiny houses for 5 years because of the after effects of the loss of the house, the floods that came through, the new culvert that the county put in, which drained right to the low spot, of course. We've regraded all that. We've seeded, and the landscaping, I think that Nina could back you up, it's clean out there. It's nothing like what we saw here. So let me just start at the beginning then of how this all came to pass that we even have this property. I met the gentleman next door, and that's one of the neighbors that sent back his comments on this issue. I bought the property from him, and his comment to me was, when I wanted it, it's awful hilly. I don't know what you're going to be able to do with that property. Well, I did. I put a three-car garage in there, all permitted in 2003. My wife and I built the home ourselves as homeowners. It was not a large home. It was 1,168 square feet. That was the original size of the home in 2003. We came from a house where we raised both our children, who are now in their late 30s, in 800 square feet, all the way through their lives, through high school, off to college. We have no desire for a 2,160 square foot house. We've been married for 44 years. Matter of fact, today is our anniversary, and all we want to do is go back home in a tiny home. And all of this came to pass when I had all the paperwork for Nina and came in and time out, we've got a problem with your barn. That's why I'm here. All of the comments that have come through Trails Association, Black Forest Land Use Committee, all have been in favor of this. All of them have been to the property, and they can see the only place left for us to put a home is above the grade of the barn. We could not make any living quarters in the barn. It's below the level of the septic system. So we're really limited, and the picture's not on there, and I don't have one. But there's an area of about 30 feet wide, and that's the distance that we have to place a house. It's impossible. There would be no way to even put a 1,200 square foot house there. It just doesn't fit. So it's for those reasons, as well as all of the comments, Nina's comments, all my neighbors are in favor. The two didn't put no comment. They had comments, and I don't know if you have that available to you guys or not, but they're very much in favor of us moving back home. And basically, folks, that's all we want. We're not trying to make ratios different. We just want to go home. And that's really all I have, unless you guys have some questions, because I spent 2 months preparing all of this, and what you all have there. And it's just the basic thing. We just want to get this approved so we can go home.
Thank you. And I failed. I apologize. Could you just introduce yourself? Our official minutes are the recording.
Yes.
Could you just introduce yourself for the record on the recording?
Sure, of course. My name is Tom Dione.
Right.
I'm here with my wife, Margie.
Thank you. And then our commissioners, I'll just ask that you be recognized so we get your names on the record. Are there any questions for the applicant?
I guess I have one. Did they, when you built the barn, did they make any requirements about, I know they relaxed requirements, but did they give any let you know about any of this future requirement?
No, as a matter of fact, and I have it right here with me, is the original site plan that was approved on. And it's in here too. Nina showed it to me earlier. It very clearly shows the barn that is existing and the future home site with very clearly a footprint much, much, much smaller. And no, this never came up until I came in with my prepared packet on the tiny home to Nina and said, this is our stumbling block first, and we can go from there. So no, it was never mentioned. But it is documented that I did ask for, in 2013, a large barn with a little house. It is clearly shown. I have it if you'd like to see it.
No, that's fine.
Okay.
I don't know if you need to recognize me for the record or not, but
yeah, no, thank you. I was going to say, Mr. Carlson, any further questions? Yeah.
Thank you. So, in any regard, your prior home that burned was much smaller than this. Anyway, half the size of the requirement.
It was 1,168 feet.
Yeah,
that's right.
Okay.
It was.
Great.
That's right. And everybody said I was crazy for building a small home. It's like, I don't want a big house.
Right. Great. Thank you.
Any other questions? Mr. Hannigan.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Your original home that burned, whereabouts was that located on the property?
Okay, great. Nina.
Nina's got a picture for
us. There it is, right there.
Okay. Okay, so it was a little bit south of perhaps of where the current barn is.
No, it would be...
Not much.
Not much, but a little bit, yes,
but a little
south.
Bit.
It's 125 feet now
right.
Where I proposed to put the tiny house. But Yeah, and you can see that it's a very small footprint house there.
Right. Yeah, as I see this, the fact that it's a tiny home has relatively little to do with the whole discussion, actually.
Well, it is. It's the stumbling block before I could even present my information.
Yeah.
That's, I've been doing this for 2 months to try to prepare for this. Which really,
I know the feeling, sir, believe me. Okay, that's all the questions I have.
Thank you, Mr. Hannigan. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
For your time, I appreciate it.
And just for the record, I see no one in the audience, but if there is anyone in the audience who wishes to speak in favor of the application or opposed, and seeing none, we'll move on. And is there any discussion by the board members on their thoughts relative to the application? Seeing none, the chair will entertain a motion. One missed to make a motion. Mr. Hannigan, would you like to make a motion today?
I think I might. Mr. Chair, as regards agenda item number 4, BOA 18002, a dimensional variance for Dione Tynel, tiny house, I move approval with two conditions and zero notations.
And thank you, and we need to cite the criterion. And I'm grateful to Mr. Shaunis for pointing that out in a previous meeting to me, that I had failed to do that. We need to, can you cite the criterion upon which you'd base that?
Right. Finding that the burden of strict compliance significantly exceed the benefits of compliance, and some other unique or equitable consideration compels that strict compliance not be required. In this case, I see several. Number one, the existing barn, which of course was legally permitted and constructed. And number two, the topography, that is specifically the drainage on the property, essentially forces them to utilize what's left of their site. And the foolishness, if not hardship, of tearing the thing down and starting over.
Thank you. We have a motion for approval on item 4, BOA 18002, dimensional variance for the Dione Tynel house with two conditions under the basis of strict compliance being outweighing the burdens of strict compliance, outweighing the benefits, and some other unique considerable considerations, including topography and others. Do we have a second?
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. So we have a motion and a second. Is there any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, the chair will hear the vote. Mr. Carlson.
Aye.
Mr. Hannigan.
Aye.
Ms. Davies.
Aye.
Mr. Thurber.
Aye.
And the chair votes aye, and the application is approved, 5-0. Okay, we have that. Are there any other items from staff? Do we anticipate a meeting next month?
We don't in April, but there may be one in May.
Okay. Any other items from the board members? And with that, thank you all. We're adjourned.